Hi, I'm Nat Coombs, host of The Nat Coombs Show on ESPN. Yep, I know, wildly original title. Hey, well, each week I get together some of the leading voices from the NFL UK family and plenty of our stateside friends too to get you up to speed on the 2020 season as we roll all the way to Tampa Bay and hopefully another Gronk beach party. So wherever you grab your pods, download and subscribe.
Well, hello, fellow baseball nuts, and a big warm welcome to the Johnny and Josh Show, episode 14, and tragically, a World Series that will not involve my mighty Braves. Congratulations to the Dodgers, who will, of course, playing the Tampa Bay Rays from the American League for this year's World Series title. We'll be talking about that a little later in the show. But first of all, let me introduce my fellow compadres, legends of British baseball, Josh Chetwynd, Eric the producer, and Big Davey Lengel. Welcome, boys. Lovely to have your company.
Thanks for having us, Gooby. We appreciate being on your podcast.
Well, yeah, thank you, Johnny.
You know, guys, I've been thinking about this. JC, I want your input on this. The Johnny and Josh Show, and yet, as we know, Eric and Dave, okay, not mentioned in the title, but we know they're like comfy sofas that you don't want to show them to the neighbors. You're a bit embarrassed about them. But when the lights are up and the curtains are drawn, they are those seats you want to be in that make you feel comfortable, make you feel warm, make you feel loved.
Goldie, to me, it's like that old show, The Love Boat, where you list all the actors and special guest stars. And they just put the old names at the end.
Old has-beens.
Yeah. Well, you are.
I'm happy to
special.
Be compared to a comfortable sofa. That's great. I've never been so flattered in my entire life.
Well, guys, can you believe we've made episode 14? And I've been looking up, as you know, I've been doing this on a regular basis every week. 14 is a number expressing personal freedom, including independence and self-determination. It's curious and interesting in pretty much everything. Yet, the number is easily distracted by other generally fleeting interests. That almost seems to sum you up, Big Davey Lengel.
Oh, I appreciate that. That's a little better than the couch.
14, it's two Mickey Mantles. We're two Mickey Mantles in.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that was my number in Jewish League basketball, just in case you're all wondering.
Hey, and let's face it, when you consider the COVID issues we've had throughout the season, what a miracle that we've made episode 14, let alone that the season has now gone 48 days COVID-free. Thumbs up for MLB. We're off to the bubble of Arlington. Fingers crossed, that's it. This is not something we even need to mention, let alone discuss.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we've had fans in the stadiums now, at least in at Globe Life, which means that, you know, it's now an interactive game again on the field and in the stadium.
Well, sadly, there is still other news to focus on. So let's get into that very issue right away as we do our general news roundup. Do love that sound effect. Makes us sound like we know what we're talking about. Well, it is very sad news to kick things off. As if this isn't a storyline that we've had to plug every week for the last number of weeks, we've lost yet another legend of baseball. And this one really does hit home because this is a part of our family. Anybody that used to join us on Channel 5 Baseball every Sunday night, ESPN, Joe Morgan, of course, was a part of the broadcasting team and was a lovely man, lovely to us. And we really bonded with him. I had the pleasure of meeting him. I think Eric met him. 10-time All-Star, 2-time World Series champ, 2-time MVP, a man who did it all, considered one of the absolute legends, not just the Houston Astros, but also, of course, Cincinnati Reds, just two of the five teams he played for, and sadly died last Sunday. So yet another RIP. We'll be talking more, obviously, detail about Joe later in the show. So let's not focus on that now. Let's move on to another big story. Rick Renteria is out at the Chicago White Sox. The manager has lost his job. This is what, only season four that he's been with the White Sox. They've agreed to part ways, guys. This is what they're saying. And when you consider they had a record of 35-25 in the regular season, pretty damn good. Admittedly, that didn't win them a title. They were runners-up in the American League Central, but then went and lost the best-of-three playoff wildcard series, so didn't even get beyond round one. Is this why the decision has been made to part ways?
Well, I have to ask David Lengel, because, of course, he chose him as his manager of the year. I do love that they chose to part ways. When I used to cover Hollywood, it was to pursue other opportunities was the catchphrase, which is basically, you've been fired, and we want to say it in a nice way. Davey, your guy's gone, man.
First of all, he was good enough to marry them to manage them for three subpar seasons, and now that he finally gets them going, you know, they finished the season 10 games over 500, and they dropped 8 out of 10 at the end. This seemed to be one of the sticking points. They drop 8 out of 10 at the end. It ruins their seeding, and then they have to go play the A's, and they lose to the A's. I don't really understand what's going on over there, especially because of the candidates who are being rumored. Josh, you know about that with Tony La Russa possibly coming back. I know Bruce Bochy wants to throw his hat into the ring, but I don't really get it.
It's going to be fascinating looking at the managerial carousel, because it had been that every manager the teams were looking for was someone young, someone who was sabermetrically, analytically focused. But what's changed that this year has been Dusty Baker's performance with the Astros. I know he didn't get him to the World Series, but all of a sudden, I think that ownership's starting to think, ooh, maybe we should get the older, steady hand. So I wonder which way the wind's going to blow when it comes to these managerial openings.
It's a little Steinbrenner-ish, though, Josh, isn't it? You know, you have a fine season. You lose in the playoffs, okay, happens all the time, and then you're out. It sounds a little Steinbrenner-ish to me.
Well, I pick up on that, Dave. I think he's their 40th manager in the Sox history, which does seem to suggest perhaps there is a bit of a tendency. You know, they're the Watford of baseball in terms of their turnover of managers.
Well, you know, I mean, Guillen was there for a while, and Ventura had a shot. I don't know about that. I just think that, you know, Reinsdorf, who is the owner of the team, is a little bit quirky, and I think he regretted losing La Russa the first time around, and maybe he's trying to bring him back for that. I can't get inside these guys' heads. He did a fine job to me. They lost 8 out of 10. That's something we called May in the old days, and this year it was down the stretch. So
yeah,
we'll see.
Well, you've already mentioned a couple of – sorry, guys. Sorry, who was
that? It'd be interesting to see that if Tony La Russa does come out of retirement, I believe he'd be the first Hall of Fame inductee to come out of retirement and to go back into management, so to speak, or let alone Major League Baseball. Because, of course, he was there in the early 80s, so it would be almost a perfect poetic fit for Tony La Russa to come out of retirement and to go back to the White Sox.
I don't see it happening. I don't think he's going to come back. Bochy, I could see coming back, but I would be shocked with La Russa.
Well, JC, you say that, buddy, but they're saying it's his job to lose now. So they wouldn't be saying that if they didn't think he was interested. I know he retired in 2011, but it's not like he's been out of baseball. He's been involved sort of, you know, in the management level. So he's kept his hand in. And he is what is he, 76? Hey, 76, guys, he's a spring chicken. Okay, some other bad news, guys. Tommy Pham, who, of course, we know has been playing with the San Diego Padres, not like he didn't have enough injury problems this season. He was out on the IL for quite some time. Can you believe it? Last Sunday, was stabbed. Now, I'm looking at a news report. It said basically he was stabbed outside a club. He saw an argument taking place near his car. He went up, told these two guys to move along. And the next thing you know, they attacked him. He was stabbed, thankfully not seriously. He's okay. He's going to be okay for next season. But that's a pretty terrifying story, isn't it, guys?
Not a whole lot of fun. I mean, you have a great night at a gentleman's club. You know, you've had a couple of drinks.
Oh, it was a gentleman's club?
What we call a gentleman's club. You know, in Canada, they may call it a peeler, right?
I'm going to digress for a second. I don't understand the allure of the gentleman's club. Beyond the objectification, you go in there and no one wants you there. They want your money. They don't want you in there.
It's not like marriage. What are you looking for, a bride?
It's not like Norm and you're so excited to be there.
Is this the platform to discuss your sexual hang-ups, JC? I thought this was meant to be a baseball podcast.
I think it is the forum, actually.
You know, I thought this was therapy for COVID. That's why I came here to work out my kinks, buddy.
Okay, well, look, clearly I don't know what happened because I'm just reading the news report. Dave, you've got the inside track. What's the story?
You were there.
I've got the inside track.
He left
the San Diego PD says he told the newspaper that it occurred shortly after 10:30 outside Pacers Showgirls International Gentlemen's Club. Police are still investigating.
That's a classy joint.
I prefer the national.
He was really. That's what I like, the international angle. I think that's great because their buffet is much better, more interesting. He was stabbed in the lower back, apparently broke all three layers of skin. Quite serious. You know, it's kind of serious to be stabbed in the. Renteria was stabbed in the back by Reinsdorf, but it wasn't a real knife. This was a real knife.
Cha cha.
And, you know,
Rib shot.
Back. He played. You know, he was in the playoffs. Obviously, he played in all three games. He had three for 11. Fam is a nice player. Always, you know, he's 32 years old. Always, you know, sad to see when something like this happens. He'll be back. He'll be good as new next year.
He stole four bases on his opening night of the season, mate, before he got injured. So he's still got something to offer. He actually said, while it was a very traumatic and eye-opening experience for me, and I think we need to be careful that we don't belittle the fact that it probably was pretty awful, I'm on the road to recovery, and I know I'll be back to my off-season training routine in no time. So we wish him a speedy and full recovery.
He'll be now, back to the strip club in no time. Don't worry about it.
Moving on swiftly to Billy Bean. Talk about stabbing in the back. This is an interesting one. Proposed deal to take the parent company of the Boston Red Sox public apparently leaves Billy Bean, the Oakland A's executive of Moneyball fame, as we all know, who ignited the whole data revolution in American sports, with a difficult choice. Because even though he's still at the A's in his original position, he's also has a financial interest in the Red Sox, part of that massive sports empire that John Henry's got going, the billionaire owner who spent nearly two decades courting Billy Bean. And so apparently this is going to create a conflict of interest, and therefore he may be leaving baseball, maybe leaving the A's. Tell us more, JC.
Yeah, so Billy Bean is, and we discussed this earlier in the season, that Billy Bean is part of a consortium to potentially purchase ownership in a football club in the UK. But that consortium also has a relationship with John Henry and the Fenway Group. And if depending on how the financial situation sets up, he would have to divest himself not only from the A's, which he owns 1% from, but it'd be a conflict of interest for him to continue to work for the A's. I think that this is sort of inevitable. I think that Bean loves the A's, obviously. You know, he's so intrinsically intertwined with them, but I think his interests now are growing broader than that, and I think that it's a matter of time before he will have to leave that team in order to spend more time and focus on this other endeavor.
A loss to baseball, Big Dave, if it happens?
Completely. I mean, this is the guy who revolutionized or helped revolutionize baseball. There's other people who were part of the statistical revolution, but he's one of the main cogs in this incredible machine. He was drafted, obviously, at a very high level in the 1980s, and he never made it. And he spent the whole career trying to figure out why everybody else thought he would be so good. And he wasn't. And that's where he tried to glean his advantage. And he's he's one of the most special people who's ever kind of walked in the door in Major League Baseball.
But
and a lot of lore attached to him. And
Dave, he's not going to leave. He's not going to leave baseball, I think, long term.
No, but he's going to end up being, to be honest, what he does, though.
To be honest, it's going to be more interesting because I think at some point he's going to be in an ownership position, and I think it would be interesting to see someone of his acumen. We haven't seen owners at his acumen. I mean, maybe, you know, Jeter's role is kind of quasi-ownership, but I'm curious to see when he gets there what he can do in that role.
But in the near future, he's going to be, you know, part of an investor, and he's looking broad, and he's becoming more interested in football, soccer, and he won't be with the A's anymore, and that's a little sad for me.
Do you not think if you know, when you're looking back on your life and wondering, was it successful, the fact that you are played by Brad Pitt in a movie sort of says it all? I mean, no one's going to be suggesting Brad Pitt for me. You know, it might be John Belushi. Well, if he was still with us. For, you know, I mean, that says everything about
I already said this, that Marty Feldman is dead. So you can't, you know, there's nobody there.
I was going to say John Belushi, who also sadly has passed his way.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
Yes, we keep referencing.
Moving on.
Okay, moving on. Well, this is the funniest story of the lot, guys. I'm loving this one. Bueller's pants. Walker Bueller, who a lot of people were tipping was going to be the breakout pitcher of the season. He's had loads of injuries, but he's still a superstar. Well, his pants have dominated the storyline. And don't talk to him about it either. This was, in the National League Championship Series game for the Dodgers. He actually imploded. They ended up losing 5-1 to the Braves in this particular game. But it wasn't the defeat that everybody was talking about, guys. It was his pants. Even in the post-game conference, that's all they wanted to talk about. And they were obscenely tight.
You mean his trousers?
His trousers. Well, I'm using American terminology. Pants as in trousers. Yes, his trousers.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we're on the right
page. Yeah, no. We're on trousers here,
okay,
Dave. We're on
you.
Trousers.
Right,
it begs the question. They were so tight. They were so small. were they actually his trousers, or did had he forgotten his and borrowed somebody else's that's a lot smaller than him? Explain what's going on.
No, I mean, that's his look, because in game six he wore them as well and pitched great. So what interested me more, everyone was talking about the tightness of his trousers, but what really was interesting to me was the length of them. So anyone who's played baseball knows that there are really two acceptable ways to wear your baseball pants. One is to wear them up high socks, which I love, you know, where you have the high socks. The other is to wear them very low and go down to your cleats. Like Manny Ramirez loved that look. If you wear it in between, which is where Buehler was wearing them, there's a term for that. It's called wearing quitters. You were just quitting. Your pants just quit on you. They couldn't go all the way to the bottom. You weren't wearing up high. And to me, that is the baseball question. You want to wear tight pants. You want to show your physique. More power to you, but know where the length is meant to be.
And that's the thing.
Go ahead, Eric.
The thing on the thing is with Buehler, before we wrap up this news round, is you can almost tell what religion he is. So there you go.
Can I pick up when he was referenced in that post-game press conference? He was told that his trousers had become a sort of Twitter sensation. This was his response. Not the time or the place. He snapped. I think he wasn't interested
there
in
you
it.
Go.
He'd obviously lost
hipster
the game,
pitcher.
So that was far more important. So, yeah.
He's a hipster
pitcher. Guys, the sad thing is, as we round up this news round, I'm assuming this may be the last news round we get a chance to do, because as we all know, when you hit to the World Series, Major League Baseball shuts down all stories. They don't want any management talks, any extension of contract talks, trading, et cetera, et cetera. They want nothing but what. So is this our last news round?
I don't know. Trevor Bauer will probably be tweeting about some trip he went on to some team. He's trying to keep the attention on him. Trevor Bauer. I don't know. Have you guys been following this on Twitter? Every time he goes to a different city, he puts on, you know, he'll Photoshop himself into a different uniform and ask local people, do you want me? It's a little cloying.
There's a meme going around that he's whittled down the teams that he wants to sign for down to 30.
Dude, you're not that important. You're not that important, man.
Guys, the world would be
he's a great pitcher, but, you know, calm down a little bit.
No. The world would be a dull place without the likes of Trevor Bauer. I love him.
I like it, but I don't like, you know, the self-aggrandizement. I like when he, you know, spouts off about ridiculous stuff. You know, I don't need to hear him promoting himself.
I agree. The look at me.
Yes. Now, that's the end of the news round, because apparently there was some playoff stuff happening.
Yes. And you've got to do your
trivia. Don't you do trivia first there, Eric?
Exactly. Yes, I do.
Normally, it's me.
We spent so long in the news round. I forgot where we were.
Eric, what do you think? We just make up this stuff as we go along?
We spent so long in the news
round. This is a highly scripted show.
I thought it was a mailbag next. Okay,
so
one voice at a time. One voice at a time. Thank you very much. So, moving on.
The answer's B.
So, the... by the way, the trivia of the week, last week's trivia, the boys...
We've got it right.
You got it right now.
Bonnie and I now have it right.
At the time of recording, you were wrong, because...
No, that wasn't... Week, you didn't tell us that until after.
Last week, one voice, please. I asked you which current manager has the most losses in the postseason. Dusty Baker's now... accumulated the most losses.
Most losses active.
And who said Dusty Baker?
Active losses.
We did. Gouldy, this is what we're talking about. Welcome to the conversation, Gouldy.
Okay. Now, this is what happens.
Make sure you remember.
This is what happens when you allow one voice at a time. Now, this week's trivia question. Out of all the managers that have made it to the postseason in this crazy 2020 season, which of these managers hit the most home runs as a player?
Ooh.
Oh my God.
Jesus.
Okay.
A chorus of oohs. I like that. So yes, was it A, Don Mattingly? Was it B, Dusty Baker? Or was it C, Aaron Boone?
This is a great question.
It's a good question.
Which of those managers who made the postseason as a player hit the most home runs, career home runs, that is? There you go.
So now Dusty Baker's taken over from Ichiro as the guy that gets a reference every week in the in-game trivia.
It sounds like it.
It's okay. Johnny B. Baker. That's his real name.
Johnny
that's
B. Right. Baker.
And that's what, yes, well, more on that later, because
Junior.
He's, you see Junior in the
Junior.
Back. Of,
right.
Actually, yeah, because he put Dusty Baker Jr. on the back of his jersey this season to honor his. Because he actually is a junior and his dad was senior. There you go. Moving on.
Okay, thank you, guys. That is the news roundup. Time now to move on to our lead-off batter discussion of the day, and it is, of course, the playoff picture. We're going to focus, first of all, on the American League Championship Series. Big Dave, take it away.
Well, first of all, we have to congratulate the Tampa Bay Rays, who have solidified themselves at the very top of Major League sports organizations, in my opinion. I mean, who is running their friend? They're in the World Series. They've defeated the Astros 4-3. They almost swallowed it. They had a big lead and they almost blew it. But here they are. It doesn't matter now. They're in. They're an incredible cast of characters. Nobody knows who they are. Nobody. They have the cast of no names, except to, you know, people who follow baseball really, really, really well. Nothing jumps off the page. And here they are, Kevin Cash's team, an incredible job. And who's a better organization in sports than the Tampa Bay Rays? I don't see it right now.
Two things. First, we should all note this is the second time the Rays have gone to the World Series, and it's very appropriate that it's occurring this year because the last time they did it was 2008, which was the last time we did our show. Were the Rays in the World Series. We come back with a podcast. The Rays are in the World Series. Does this mean that if we do this next year, the Rays are going to, they're going to be a dynasty because we, you know, we only broadcast Rays World Series now. But I think what is amazing about this team, and I talked about this last week, which is their front office, Eric Neander and the rest of that team have been beyond amazing in trades. Randy Rosarena, who won the ALCS MVP, he was almost a throw-in in the trade where he came over from St. Louis. You had Jose Martinez, who was kind of the big name, and they were trading those two guys and some other pieces really for a pitcher named Matt Liberatore, who I was still working as an agent at the time. And this guy was the biggest prospect of any high school pitcher. I mean, he was such a big star. And I remember this trade and thinking, oh my God, they're giving up Liberatore for Martinez. And I don't even know who this other guy is, but this is how good the Rays are, is that they take these pieces. You look at that bullpen, the Peter Fairbanks, the Nick Andersons, they are better talent evaluators than almost anyone else. And that is reflective on how successful they are. To your point, Dave, these aren't household names, yet they understand how good they are and how to patchwork it together. And you know, we slept on them most of the season, right? They were the number one team in the American League. Yeah. They earned this. And yet we're talking about this as some sort of surprise. And that shows how good they are and how weak ass we are.
But you sleep on them because they're just not sexy in any way, shape, or form. They play in Tampa. They don't have a tremendous amount of support from their fan base. They have a lousy ballpark and, you know, their uniforms are kind of crap. And you're in the AL East with the Giants. You got the Red Sox and the Yankees, and Toronto is a big fan base. And you forget about them, and they snap up on you, and they sneak up on you. But it's funny, in a team where you talk about trades being so important and how they really lack free agents, one of the only free agents I believe they have on their team is Charlie Morton. And this guy, they pick him up, and he comes, he's money. Elimination game, he comes through again. I mean, the savvy of this ball club to do what they do with the budget they have, you just run out of superlatives.
Example. Just to finish on Morton, he's a perfect example, which is that he was a buy low free agent. It wasn't even like they made a big splash with him. I mean, they have been so savvy from top to bottom. And one thing when they were talking after they won the championship series is, and we forget this, is the chemistry is an intangible that needs to always be considered, and we always forget it. And this is a team that clearly loves to play together. We saw that when Rosarena and Brett Phillips were doing a dance-off. I mean, these guys love to play together, and that has to count for something, too.
And I've got to pick up, guys, on a couple of comments you just made. When you look at the record they have, this isn't a fluke. They had the best record in the American League by a margin in a very strong division. And as you rightly say, they've made the World Series. There's no fluke in this. They've earned it. They justify it. This is all done on a $70 million payroll. That's almost a third of some of the other teams they're up against. So my question to you guys, will this herald in a new way of building a ball club? Will this be the start of an attitude that another teams will adopt?
You can't emulate it necessarily. You know, there's not a blueprint for it. It just requires an ability to assess talent that either you have or you don't have. And money is like a safety blanket, right? So what money does for you is it allows you to create redundancy that protects against failure. So that's what teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox do. They not only have the full-time player, they have the second guy and the third guy. We see this in football all the time, right? Is that what money allows you to do is to create the depth that if the first guy doesn't work out, you have the second guy. And that, again, is why the Rays were so good is – their margin for error should be less because they don't have the money to get that next level guy. Yet they were so smart about the people that they had that even when they did go to that second level, their assessment of talent was so much better than anyone else. So I don't think you're going to see a change in strategy because you can't say, okay, I'm just going to be better at choosing players. You just can't do that.
And the Rays have to, they do it by necessity, and the Red Sox and bigger clubs are never going to be in a position with their fan bases to pass on talent that they need immediately and can actually purchase. And to your point, JC, that's a great comment. I mean, money is the great protector. What the Yankees do so well is cover up mistakes by just spending more. Jacoby Ellsbury is a huge example. They give him piles and piles of money. That kind of mistake would cripple poorer organizations for years, but he just, you know, hides out down in Florida for all year rehabbing, and it makes no difference in their ball club whatsoever.
Well, and the irony, of course, right, is that the Rays for a long time were really bad at some of these elements. You think back, they had all these number one draft picks. They drafted Josh Hamilton at a time before Josh Hamilton was good and was dealing with all his issues. I think it was Delman Young. They had just a whole list of these first round draft picks where they swung and missed over and over again. And, you know, there was a book written about this, The Extra 2%, where they sort of figured out how to recalibrate what they were doing. And clearly they're firing on all cylinders.
Do you rate manager Kevin Cash? Because I'm just rewinding to game six. Blake Snell was pitching great. I think he'd done four innings. He hadn't given up any runs. And then they got their first two hitters on base in the fifth, and he took him out. And it was pretty fortuitous on both occasions that these hitters got on base. And Snell looked really unhappy. And I questioned that decision at the time. What do I know? What's your thoughts about Kevin Cash? Do
you think he's big fan of his. And you know what he did that doesn't get enough credit is he really understood how to get players in and out of the lineup. So, you know, Hunter Renfroe struggling, he's out, but he came back in and kept all those players mentally in it so that when they did get their opportunity, you know, Mike Brasso, great example too. Starting, comes in, he obviously makes an impact. He was really good at being able to juggle his pieces and make each of those pieces feel like they were a part of it, even when they weren't in the game. And that is a tremendous talent as a manager.
And also sticking to the game plan, Johnny. You know, there is a temptation with a guy like Snell, and indeed the next game in game seven, Morton was cruising along. And I think with other organizations, you might second guess more because most other organizations play in a more traditional way where they lean on a starting pitcher to go, you know, 5, 6, 7 and onwards. But the Rays game plan all along this season was, you know, to keep starters 4 or 5, and they weren't about to break from that now. But, you know, I think what I'd really like to end with is the most important thing about these two clubs, what has really had me aghast is these clubs like Houston and the Dodgers down getting pummeled, and the Dodgers getting overrun by the Braves in this series. You think it's going to be over in a snap, and the resiliency of baseball players in general. JC, you could speak to this better. I could tell you right now that any kind of adversity in my life, I crumble. Like, I'm done. I start complaining. I start making excuses, blaming other people. And these guys sit in the dugout and watch Freddie Freeman hitting the ball all over the place, Acuna hitting the ball all over the place, and Houston just getting crushed by the Rays. And they just keep playing. And they just keep their cool. And I just find that an extraordinary thing about a professional athlete, to be able to just kind of keep playing and hanging in there. And Josh, you know a little bit more about that than me.
Not team spirit, JC? Is that not exactly what that is?
No, it's actually something different when all great players are sort of taught this, which is that you have to bend the at-bat before. We're not even talking the game before, but the at-bat before. Because, you know, if you have a bad at-bat, you carry it into the field. You're always told, don't carry your at-bats into the field. Don't carry your at-bat from one to the other. And the great players are able to do that. They're able to compartmentalize. And, you know, we haven't really talked about the Astros, who are so thoroughly disliked because of trash can game, that we're able to to claw a little bit of that back with their activity and showing what professionals they were. I mean, really, that's what they were in each of these games, which is that they were able to compartmentalize failure and then move on and improve their performance each time. And you have to tip your hat to that, whether you think that they are a bunch of cheaters or whatever. Credit where credit is due.
Exactly.
The problem with the Astros is Dusty Baker. He's the biggest problem because you hate the Astros. You hate what they did. For me, what they did is in many ways worse than performance enhancing drugs. I mean, it was basically an organizational group effort, maybe not everybody, but certainly a lot of the players to try and cheat this game, which is one of the biggest crimes we can have. And they all got let off the hook, completely let off the hook. And then they bring in Dusty. And everybody loves Dusty. This is the best move they've made in a decade. Because now I'm watching them, right? They're getting smoked. And they start coming back. And I get into the Astros a little bit. I don't want to be into the Astros. I hate them because of Dusty. It's not fair.
Well, there you go. That's because I was actually rooting for them to come back from 3-0 down and become only the second baseball team to do so in the history of best of seven, just because of Dusty. And I would love to see Dusty win a World Series finally. But on another note, with that ALCS, you guys mentioned about Charlie Morton. When I saw this set, I couldn't believe it. He is the only pitcher in Major League history to have won 3 game sevens in the postseason.
Incredible.
And and also and he's 4-0 and winner takes all and with a 0.46 ERA. And yeah, what a pickup Charlie Morton was. And going back on what you're saying about Ranty Rosarena, you got to think back. He was he defected from Cuba back in 2015, and he had COVID earlier this summer. Only played his first game of the season on August 30th. Look at this. Less than 2 months later, he's ALCS MVP.
He has been amazing, hasn't he?
Fantastic.
How come that never happens to me?
You need to go to Cuba.
Why can't I defect and become like an ALCS MVP?
Well, there you go. There's your ALCS roundup.
Okay. Well, guys, JC, I think I've put it off long enough. We've now got to speak about the National League Championship Series. And I have to say, I'm still wearing my Braves shirts because I'm proud of my boys, JC. But you have to tip your hat. At the end of the day, the Dodgers proved that they basically are the best team in the National League. To come back from 3-1, I believe they're only the 14th team ever to do that from that sort of a deficit and win 3 straight to go to the World Series. They've earned the right to be there.
For sure, Gouldy. And they had the lineup that was built to grind out the type of at-bats that you needed to come back from that sort of deficit. And we saw it in Game 7. I mean, they had 8 pitch at-bats, 9 pitch at-bats. They'd foul off pitches until there was just nothing left but to throw one down the middle. We saw that with Chris Martin, the home run from Cody Bellinger in that Game 7. So, you know, the Dodgers are the deserving team, and I think as strange as this year has been, when we get to the World Series to see the number one seed in the American League, the number one seed in the National League playing each other, it's almost strange, but it makes sense. Yeah. You know, we would think that there'd be one team that would sneak in. The Astros were trying to be that spoiler, but the Dodgers deserve to be there, and I think it will make for a great setup. Their depth and pitching showed really well in this series, particularly in the last game. Urias being able to come in and throw 3 innings late in that game was really clutch for them. Tip your hat to them, but you know, your Braves, Gouldy, commiserations, because they not only had a great season, but they did it with a lot in their way, a lot of obstacles. No Cole Hamels, Soroka getting injured, Felix Hernandez opting out, and yet they found ways with guys like Ian Anderson, Max Fried stepping up to the occasion. You know, they're getting great offensive performances up and down the lineup, and they deserve tremendous credit for a great year. And I know they're not going to the World Series for you, but you did win your fantasy league, so you know, you take the good with the bad, Gould.
That's what I love about you, buddy. You've denied me the opportunity to talk fantasy for 14 episodes, but now you feel like I need a bit of love. I need a bit of a hug. So you're bringing it in, and I appreciate it.
You keep it in the hip pocket till you need it, Gouldy.
It's my comfort running kit, big guy. Yeah. But just to talk a little bit more about the series, you referenced to the Dodgers being dogged. I mean, it just astounded me how patient they were. We talk about that Game 7, which I found one of the most exhausting, stressful games, probably the most stressful game of baseball I've ever watched in my baseball-watching career. That says something when you consider how many games you and I have watched together. But I have to say that their doggedness, their patient at-bats, there was one point in the game when I think it was around the sixth, and the commentators made reference to it, and I had spotted it. I think they had faced, I think the Atlanta Braves had faced 50% less pitches around the sixth inning. They were on about 140-odd. We were around the 90 mark, which tells its own story. We're swinging from the hips. And is that perhaps, for Braves fans out there that, like me, are depressed as hell right now, is that perhaps the lesson that needs to be learned, that they need to be a little bit more patient? They need to maybe play a bit more small ball?
I do think that the Dodgers are a unique team in that way. You look at their lineup and you look at statistics, the basic statistics, batting average, and you see that Max Muncy hit under 200. Jock Peterson hit under 200 for the whole season, admittedly, 60-game season. And Cody Bellinger, who's coming off an MVP year, hit 239. But the reason that those statistics don't matter are for what you're talking about. They're unique in that way. This is not a press against the Braves and what they did short. It's really, you have to lift up the Dodgers because they are unique in that ability, and they're going to need to have that against a team like the Tampa Bay Rays, who have that depth of pitching. They have that relief pitching that can really compare, and they're going to need to have those kind of at-bats yet again for another series if they want to finally win a World Series since 1988, first one since.
I'm looking for reasons. I'm looking for explanations for why the Braves, when you consider they were 2-0, they were 3-1 up, they've gone and lost three straight. This was their first opportunity to go to the show since, 1999, only the third year of Channel 5 baseball. And I'm looking for reasons. And one of them, Travis Darno, who's been absolutely awesome, so I don't want to have a go at him. But I'm just wondering about the decision by the manager to play him in all seven games. Now, I know he pulled him in Game 3 when basically after the first inning, we were lost. So he only actually had the one at bat. But when you consider how good he has been, I had a quick look. He's gone 4-for-23 in those seven games for a guy who has been hitting for fun. Is that possibly one decision the manager is going to regret?
No, I honestly don't think so, Goldie, as someone who caught and knows that you can grind out 7-8 games in really pressure situations. I remember there was a European Championship where I played every game, 7-8 games, and I don't feel that my performance was affected by the amount I played. In fact, I felt I got stronger as I went because more and more was on the line as we went along. If you're looking for criticism, I think that there were some mental mistakes on the part of the Braves at certain times, particularly in base runnings. Marcell Ozuna earlier in the series, and then in Game 7, I think that Austin Riley, more so than even, I think it was Dansby Swanson who was on third base who got thrown out at home.
Yep.
That's for Swanson. It's you're going first contact sometimes, and so he broke early. You know, it was a really hard hit ball. That happens. But what Austin Riley has to do when he's on second base is that if you're going to try and get to third, as soon as the runner in front of you is in a rundown, you've got to break to the next base. You can't sort of equivocate. You can't wait. You either go or you don't go. And he waited. And losing the one out was a big deal. Getting the double play in that situation, that was backbreaking for that team at a time where you couldn't afford it.
And there were, as you say, it seemed like mental mistakes. Perhaps that's a lack of experience. Perhaps that's just the nerves of the occasion. There was one of our relief pitchers, Mazkek, who kept looking over to, they had a runner on first and second. They then got moved over due to a wild pitch, and he was so concerned about them stealing a base. He kept looking. And John Smoltz was part of the commentary team, and he kept saying, focus on the plate, focus on where you want to throw the ball. And he ended up making a mistake and giving up a big hit. These tiny little mistakes, and you add them all together and you've got yourself a one-run ball game. That's the irony of all this. How close a series was this? It goes the full seven games, and in the end, it's separated by one run.
I mean, you could gravitate to the small errors, but you really have to lift the Dodgers up. I think it was more about their success than the Braves' failure. And it's not just their hitting. I mean, their defense was amazing. Cody Bellinger in center field. I mean, Mookie Betts. We're in a new era of Mookie. Mookie Betts stole a home run in Game 7. So, you could sit here and you can like play the game over in your head, which I'm sure you will do as the devoted Braves fan you are. But you gotta just realize the Dodgers are potentially a team of destiny here. And it was a great series. Both teams played great and the Dodgers just found a way.
And it did feel like it was destiny, I have to say, as a Braves fan. And therefore, I am destined to now just go and find a dark, warm corner and just crawl into it and get into that sort of, you know, cuddly position and find some comfort blanket somewhere and just suck my thumb for the next couple of hours.
All right. Well, we'll give you a moment, but we're nowhere near done with the show, Goldie.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks, JC. And let's now rewind to the American League Championship Series. We all know that sport involves those moments when superstar professionals just completely lose the plot, often referred to as the yips. Now, never had that problem in my professional career, but someone of the incredible stature of Jose Altuve, to see him suffering the yips when he's just trying to throw a baseball, what, about 20 yards? It's extraordinary, JC. I can't get my head around how it happens, why it happens, and to happen in a situation that ultimately cost them not one but two games in that ALCS. I mean, take us through it. What's your experience? Have you ever suffered from the yips playing baseball?
Yes, and I will talk about that momentarily. Let me just explain exactly what happened for any of our fans who don't even know what the yips are. So the yips are a mental block that occurs with throwing, that all of a sudden you sort of get out of mechanical form, and then mentally you can't find your way back. And this happened to Jose Altuve, as you mentioned, Gouldie, in Game 2 and Game 3. In Game 2, two outs in the first inning. He has a routine ground ball. He throws the ball away. Manuel Margot then hits a home run, a three-run home run. That ended up being the difference of the game. In Game 3, the Astros were up 1-0 in the sixth inning, and ground ball set up double play for Altuve. He throws over to Correa, botches the throw again. As a result, the Rays go on to score five runs, and as you pointed out, was difference-making. Altuve's not alone. This is something that's happened in baseball many times and in very different positions. So at second base, this has been a common occurrence. The two most famous examples are Chuck Knoblauch, who played for the Minnesota Twins and the New York Yankees, had tremendous difficulty throwing, so much so he had to move to the outfield. Steve Sachs, who was a former Rookie of the Year with Los Angeles Dodgers, had a similar problem. It's happened with pitchers. Rick Ankiel is probably the most famous, and a guy named Steve Glass with the Pirates. Ankiel had ended his career as a pitcher. He ended up having to come back as an outfielder. But what's a little closer to home was a catcher by the name of Mackie Sasser, who played for the New York Mets, who created a mental block with throwing the ball back to the pitcher. He couldn't throw the ball back to the pitcher. He would sort of fake throw because it was so mental. And it's actually something that I had to deal with early on in my career. In high school, in my senior year, I had a slight tear in my rotator cuff. And all of a sudden, my throwing became a little more difficult down to second base. And a couple of times, because of this, I had difficulty throwing the ball back to the pitcher. And it got in my head quite a bit, so much so that I actually changed the way I threw the ball back to the pitcher, where I threw a little bit more of a short arm instead of coming back farther. And it's a real thing. And it became something when I was catching and you're receiving, you really want to focus in, A, on calling the game, and then B, on receiving, that it was in the back of my mind. I was like, okay, after the throw, I'm going to have to throw the ball back to the pitcher. And as a number of people have mentioned, Brandon McCarthy, who was a great pitcher, had some yips issues. Steve Sachs was interviewed after the Altuve situation. You feel so alone, and it just ends up suffocating you because it's all you can think about. So I really feel for Altuve, but it's a reflection of what a great player he is, that he was able to overcome that in a short period of time. A lot of these players, it carries with them for the rest of their career, for a large portion of their career.
And begs the question, guys, when we talk about yips, it always seems to be about throwing. You don't talk about a hitter having the yips. They're just in a slump. Is that a fair comment? It tends to be about throwing the ball, because the only other time I've come across the concept of the yips in professional sport is in cricket. I've had a couple of my mates in my cricket team who have developed the yips, and they end up trying to bowl a ball and they cannot hit the, they throw it 50 yards over the batsman's head. It's always when it's about throwing. It never seems to be about even kicking, let alone hitting.
Yeah, the reason for that is that throwing is such a fundamental part of the game. People strike out all the time, so you can kind of hide that failure a little bit, and it doesn't get in your head. You're just in a slump, and you can rationalize that. But every kid who started playing baseball, and by the time you get to the major leagues, you're expected to be able to make the simple throw. It's such a foundational part of your skill set. And if you can't do that, that gets in your head, because you can't talk that away. You can't say, oh, I'm in a throwing slump, because no right. one should ever be in a throwing slump at that level.
Dave, presumably you've never had this problem because you have no sporting talent.
No, hang on a second. That's not true. I remember playing self-hitting baseball on the street, and I got the yips. No, in all seriousness, got the yips.
Well, playing on your own.
I was throwing the ball. I kept going. I'm moving my arm.
Got the yips with yourself?
No. We're all playing in the street, and I would be, by a couple of sewer holes down. And I would be throwing it in, and I couldn't throw it. And I would wind up running the ball all the way in and just handing it to them. It was crazy, and you could not figure out why. By the way, Johnny, I have to point something out. You say you've never had the yips in your professional career. I just want to point out that as soon as you said that, you slurred your words, which is important to know.
You've been calling
schmucks like us can get the yips.
That's my dentures. That's got nothing to do with
Goldie, you've been calling Jose Altuve Jose all season. You have had the yips. You didn't even know you had the yips.
Yeah, that's because we call the special one Jose. We've always called him Jose, and it's spelled the same. So it's an easy mistake to make.
No,
that's not the yips. Jose. That's just a lack of professionalism. That's just a lack of preparation. It's not the yips, right? Eric, what about you? Have you ever had the yips when you've been trying to barbecue a sausage?
What happens behind closed doors?
Trying to put it on the grill.
Are you talking about? Are you talking about actual sausages? Exactly.
Please, it's a family show. Oh, now, by the way, you say that, Johnny, that it seems to be only throwing, but here in the UK there were two athlete, if you want to call them that, instances of the yips. And when I mean athlete, I'll get a lot of flack for saying this. Eric Bristow of the darts world had the yips.
Yeah, well, he's throwing a dart.
He's throwing with his athletic logger.
Very athletic.
Yeah.
But apparently he suffered from the yips, and it was very evident apparently on a televised broadcast of World Darts one year. But also snooker's Stephen Hendry suffered from the yips and couldn't follow through on the cue ball for a while, and somehow he managed to overcome it. But fascinating.
I can't even begin to tell you how difficult it is to overcome it once you've gotten it. It's something that sticks in your head. It comes to the forefront. It's a really tough thing. So
It's not helped by your teammates giggling hysterically as we've done on the iconic Riverbank Ramblers cricket team. I'm assuming your fellow teammates didn't do the same, JC.
No, and going back to Altuve, I think one of the reasons he was able to overcome it was his teammates had his back 150%. Yeah. Correa was saying like, oh, it was my fault. I mean, trying to take the pressure off the player.
Hey, but buddy, was it game 4 and 5 or game 3 and 4 that happened? It was game 3 and 4, wasn't it?
Two and three.
Apparently before game 4, he was like an hour just literally throwing the ball from second base to first base.
Yeah.
And apparently never missed one. But he spent an hour doing it.
I think one of the advantages he had was no fans in the stadium. I think that would have maybe elongated that problem. But the fact that you don't have those people, because you think about that too. You think people are looking at me. I'm the center of attention at this moment that is the most embarrassing moment of my career.
Guys, I'm sorry. I know we need to round this up, but can I ask one question? And this has got nothing to do with yips. We were just talking about the Houston Astros and how you want to hate them, but you can't help but admire what they did coming back from 3 down and almost pulling off the miracle. For me, Correa, I can't believe how impressed I've been with him as a team leader. I was watching him in terms of the way he communicated with his teammates. My Lord, has he gone up in my estimations? That boy has got some serial leadership talent.
And there you go. So did it cost the Astros the series? Unfortunately, I think the answer is yes.
Brutal. Brutal. Wow. Okay, moving on. And the third story, the third batter in our lineup, the saddest one of all, the passing of Joe Morgan, baseball legend, player, and of course, broadcaster. Just doing a little bit of research into his life, guys. Old as a 6 kids, born in Texas, known as Little Joe. Didn't realize he was this small, even though I met him, 5'7". And amazingly, didn't receive any offers from Major League ball clubs because of his size. So played college baseball when he started. And as a result of what he did there, got picked up by what was known as the Houston Colt 45s. Of course, the Astros played 10 years there, which was great. But it was when he joined the Reds that it all kicked off big time, as we know, as part of the big red machine alongside the legends that were Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Tony Perez, to name but a few. And his two best years when he was NL MVP, 75-76 World Series winning years. They said, some say, the greatest stealer of all time, is what some have said. 689 career steals with a greater than 80% success rate. You look at all the other stats, guys. What a career in terms of a five-time Gold Glove Award winner. He's the Hall of Fame in not just Cincinnati, but in Houston as well. And, of course, also a first-round baseball Hall of Famer. And then goes on to have a Hall of Fame career in the broadcasting booth, which is where, of course, we came across him on Sunday Night Baseball with Joe, with John Miller and Joe Morgan. I mean, it's such a sad to hear that he's passed away at the tender age of 77. Not even exactly a senior age. I mean, massively unexpected. JC, I'm gutted by this one. Gutted by all the previous ones because they're baseball legends. But this one does feel like family.
Absolutely. I mean, there was something really special about Joe Morgan and John Miller on Sunday nights. To me, they epitomized what you wanted in a broadcaster in that experience, which is it's late in the afternoon, in our case in the UK, late at night, and you want sort of a calming, enjoyable effect from your broadcasters. The feeling that you're in a pub with two guys who know something about baseball, who are walking you through it and having a good time. And the irony about Joe Morgan and his approach to broadcasting was that he looked at players in a more holistic sense, like, oh, that guy can run, that guy can throw, sort of the more general stuff. And he was criticized tremendously for not embracing the sabermetric analytics, which were statistics that actually spoke to his greatness. He had a WAR, wins over above replacement, of over 100. He was one of the greatest sabermetric players, and yet that was not something that he really cared about. And so he was criticized a lot. There was actually a website that was called Fire Joe Morgan because they felt that he was almost reductive in his approach towards looking at players. To me, he was fantastic. He was everything that I wanted. He was relaxed. He was enjoyable. It made you feel like you were sitting back on your, you know, your porch, drinking some tea on a, you know, on a Sunday night and enjoying baseball.
Dave, you wouldn't have been drinking tea. I imagine you'd have been drinking something a little bit stronger, but I imagine you, like the rest of us, got quite emotional about this one.
I loved Joe Morgan and I loved John Miller for all the reasons that Josh said. And I think one of the great tributes to Joe Morgan, ironically, is that ESPN haven't even come close to filling those shoes since he left. And when you look at the different combinations that they've tried over the years, the broadcast has become kind of a contrived few hours of pre-rehearsed bits and trying to point out these, you know, little micro points that are, you know, that make them seem as if they've been sort of digging and digging and digging for weeks to find them, instead of just sitting around and having a chat in a warm, intimate environment. And ESPN have over-engineered that. And I miss that. And I think they really miss the point. And the point is exactly what Josh said, is to just have a fun place to listen to baseball on a Sunday night or maybe even a Wednesday night. But I want to briefly talk about bad trades and great trades. And, you know, let's not forget the baseball part of Morgan for a bit, just the way he revolutionized power and speed and the incredible year that he had in his two MVP seasons. And here's the trade, guys, because you remember the Reds were kind of struggling to find themselves. They had a nice core, but they were missing something. That something turned out to be Joe Morgan. Traded by the Astros with Ed Armbrister, Jack Billingham, Cesar Geronimo, and Dennis Menke to the Reds for Tommy Helms, Lee May, and Jimmy Stewart. I mean, now Morgan wasn't the player that he became when he was with Houston. He was a two-time All-Star. He wasn't the player yet, but he had shown signs, and this has to go down as one of the worst trades in history for the Astros and the best for the Reds.
Yeah, and Jack Billingham ended up being a key cog to the pitching rotation for the Reds during their dynastic period. He was called the Little General, and there was a reason for that, is that he was such a leader on the field, and he was not the first. I mean, there were many previous to him, but he was certainly a five-tool player. I mean, he had every aspect. He could run. He had a good arm. He could play defense. He could hit, and he could hit for power. He was a guy who brought every element of the game. And as a reminder in baseball, right, like size is overrated. We look at all these sports and we see that guy's a specimen. The phrase that we say, he looks good coming off the bus. He might not have looked good coming off the bus, but put him in the field and that guy was a baller.
Love that. You mentioned his leadership qualities. 1982, he won the Willie Mack Award, which was for spirit and leadership. So it was clearly something that was recognized as a player. I want to pick up on your comments, though, about as a broadcaster. And JC, you were talking about what it was about him and John Miller that was so special. I noticed that they were replaced when their contracts weren't renewed back in the end of 2010, originally replaced by Bobby Valentine and Dan Shulman. And Bobby Valentine, great character. But he's not that sort of comfy slippers, you know, that sort of nice, warm, cuddly feeling that you were referring to. And I agree with you. And I think that's where they've gone wrong. They've gone for the spiky, for the unpredictable. When on a Sunday night, you don't want that. You want the comfort. You want the slippers, those famous old slippers you've had for 20 years and you won't let the missus throw out because they fit and they're yours and you know where you stand with them.
But going one step further, I think David's spot on, which is I think they've even gone beyond that to just being overly slick. It's like you want it to feel, like you're saying, Gouldie, warm and friendly. Slick is not what you want. You don't want the used car salesman trying to sell you a couple statistics to show how smart they are on your Sunday night. You want two guys chatting. I mean, this is why all the great broadcasters did this. This is Vin Scully, too. He made you feel like you were there with some buddies and you were enjoying it. I mean, I know all four of us, that's what we tried to do with our show, which was – give that feel of like, hey, we're chatting and you could be in the conversation too. And they were so good at that.
And that was referenced by a lot of the viewers of Channel 5 Baseball as one of the reasons that they were so popular and the show, obviously, they felt a part of. I just want to quickly go, though, guys, before we round this bit up, let's just talk about him as the player. And I want your view on this. Baseball historian Bill James, first of all, said he perhaps is one of the greatest percentages player in baseball history. This picks up what you were saying, JC, due to his strong fielding percentage, stolen base percentage, walk to strikeout ratio, walks per plate appearance ratio, et cetera, et cetera. He goes further and says in his eyes, he is the greatest second baseman in baseball history. Now, Joe Morgan, interestingly, thought that was rubbish. What's your thoughts? Is he the all-time great second baseman?
I think analytically, yeah. It's funny, when I was a kid, he was a star, and he had a very unique batting stance, too. So he would move his, he would kind of move his elbow before he would swing. He was so iconic in the way he played. And there have been some other great second basemen, there's no doubt about it. But I think he revolutionized that position, as David mentioned, into the power speed combo. I think before him, you could put a light hitting second baseman who could play defense, maybe hit for a little average. But to have that combination of speed and power, I don't think there was anyone who compared with him before him.
JC, do you know the story about the elbow? How that all came about?
No, you got that
stuff. Okay, yeah. Early in his career, apparently he was having trouble with his swing. This was when he was with Houston, because he kept his back elbow down too low. And apparently it was... it was just position. It was technique. Teammate Nelly Fox, described as a stocky second baseman. I like that.
One of the greats. Stocky. Nelly Fox, the Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow,
yeah. He suggested to Morgan that while at the plate, he should flap his back arm like a chicken to keep his elbow up. And Morgan followed the advice and his flapping arm became Morgan's signature. That's the story. The chicken wings. Exactly. There you go. Exactly. That's great.
That's it. Well, we speak big goodbye to a family member and to a true legend. Rest in peace, Joe Morgan.
Okay, well, that leads off and finishes off. First leadoff batter, first pitch, second pitch, third pitch. And now we move on to the seventh inning stretch.
Now we will continue talking about the halcyon days of our Channel 5 days, where our baseball book of the week is going to be, and people think this is written about me, but it's actually Confessions of a Baseball Purist by John Miller.
Oh,
so the John Miller wrote a book. Now, here's the thing. We've met John Miller, as Johnny alluded to, a few times, and Joe Morgan. And yes, they were pretty much part. For people of a certain age here in the UK, yes, Joe Morgan and John Miller were part of growing up with baseball broadcasting here in the United Kingdom. And if you're a fan of our old show, this will sort of tie everything together. The one thing I don't like about the book is that John Miller admits that interleague play It shouldn't happen, but it is essential for the evolution of the game. Now, you know my thoughts about
Interleague. That's fair.
No, it's
that's not a purist, though, right? Like that's
no, but he disgruntlingly accepts Interleague play, even though prefers it without. He says in the book that he prefers just being the natural rivalries, but I just say, no, let's just get rid of it completely and keep AL and NL separate, but that's for another story. He, of course, now John Miller was also the broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles. He goes into complete details here about young Cal Ripken Jr. and how Cal Ripken Jr. was such a competitor that anyone remember Strat-O-Matic Baseball?
Of course.
Strat-O-Matic Baseball with this card game that is kind of like pre-fantasy baseball league, but
Ethan Hernandez loves Strat-O-Matic baseball.
Exactly. So basically, for those who don't know what Strat-O-Matic baseball is, Google it later. But apparently,
pre-fantasy baseball. What a ridiculous concept! There's no such thing as pre-fantasy baseball. That's like saying there was a Jesus before the Son of God. Nonsense.
Okay. What? Well, we'll go down that route here.
Okay.
But apparently, on plane trips, for away trips, Cal Ripken Jr. was obsessed with playing Strat-O-Matic baseball with his teammates and John Miller, who would be on the Baltimore Orioles flight.
He must have bored them to death.
And he, exactly. Yeah. And that's what John Miller said. He was so obsessed that he couldn't play Strat-O-Matic baseball with Cal Ripken Jr. because he just throws such a hissy fit on the plane about when he lost.
He would have been really competitive, right? About it, and it would have been really annoying.
That's like Michael Jordan with ping pong. Like, he couldn't lose ping pong. He'd freak out on table tennis.
So how long was the streak, guys?
You know, guys, you said 10,000 or something. Didn't last.
No, I didn't. I know exactly how many it is.
Oh, I said again?
We've referenced it three times during this podcast this year. I'm just wondering if anybody's remembered or listened.
It's the only thing that sticks in your brain, Gould.
Yes, exactly.
It's like the only thing you've got.
2,632.
Fantastic. Okay, which is also referenced in this book as well, by the way, which he says, which goes into detail, that on the night that he broke the record, Cameron Jr. had a fever but continued playing. So there you go. But also, my favorite story, a little segment in this book, is in the off season, John Miller and his wife went to visit an island called San Andres, which is a Colombian island off the coast of Nicaragua.
Very good pronunciation there.
And his wife took a cruise to Central America, got off of the island of San Andres, and got into a taxi. And the taxi driver says, "Are you John Miller?" Yes, he actually phonetically writes Miller. He goes, "Yes, I am John Miller." And he goes, "Oh, welcome to San Andres. Where's Joe? Where's little Joe?"
Oh.
And then he says, "Well, no, I'm on holiday with my wife." And he goes, "How can you come to San Andres without little Joe? Where's Joe?" And apparently the taxi driver was so angry that John Miller dared go on holiday in the offseason without Joe Morgan.
But joined to the hip.
Confessions of a Baseball Purist. Very recommended book for people of a certain age who watch our show. Fantastic. But you know, just watch it. Come on. John Miller is a legendary broadcaster as well. Let's give him his dues. Moving on. We have, I could also mention this for Josh, Curling Basics.
Yay! I don't need the basics anymore.
Curling Baseball Book of the Week. There we go.
Nice. It's one of my books.
Movie references. So since we've been watching the Dodgers this week, I thought I'd throw in Herbie the Love Bug. But Eric, Herbie the Love Bug as a baseball film, you may ask? Ask away.
Eric.
Now, apparently, that's what people say, like, you know, why is Herbie even connected to baseball? Well, the producer of Herbie the Love Bug and the Herbie the Love Bug series, Herbie Goes Bananas, Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo. People might remember this Disney film of a Volkswagen Beetle.
Dean Jones? Was that who was the actor?
Yes, it was Dean Jones, actually. That's right, yes. Okay. But the producer, Bob Walker, actually, was such an obsessed Los Angeles Dodgers fan that he wanted to make sure that, you know, he wanted to give the Volkswagen Beetle a little bit of a look, that it had like racing stripes and a number on it. And because he was such a Dodgers fan and a Don Drysdale fan, he made sure that 53 is on the Beetle, which was Don Drysdale's number. And there's a blue and white pinstripe and with a red edging for the numbers that are on the Dodge uniforms. And so basically it's Don Drysdale in a vehicular form is Herbie the Love Bug. There you go. Wow, did you know this?
They could have used him as a bullpen cart.
They could have actually. There you go. So yeah. So Don. So that's why there's number 53.
I think Herbie could have played second base. Herbie would just, you know,
he'd have the yips.
He was very nimble.
Yeah.
There you go. But also I figured since the Rays are through to the World Series, I throw in The Rookie with Dennis Quaid. As our another baseball movie this week, Dennis Quaid plays a true story about Jim Morris, a 35-year-old pitcher who gets called up by the Tampa Bay Devil Rays at the time, and which just goes to show is a feel-good story that you're never too old. Well, maybe we are to chase your dreams and just chase those rainbows.
I actually love that movie. Just so Jim Morris hurt his arm. He had actually been a bit of a prospect when he was younger and then went and was a coach for a high school team. And from throwing batting practice, he strengthened up his arm enough and his players said, if we do well enough in our season, will you try out again? Because they believed he still had it. And he went and that was the story. You know, it's Disney all the way. There's no doubt about it, Eric. But it worked for me. I thought it was a sweet, fun movie.
You know, it's a cheesy, schmaltzy movie. But, you know, it's a feel-good
movie. David Lengel has no heart.
Let me tell you something, David.
Before we get into your usual brand of unique negativity, JC, is the story really accurate of the movie? Because I'm a complete sucker for these type of movies. Is it, you know, like the broken relationship with his father and his dad watched him when he came and struck out three in his first ever major league and mended their relationship? I mean, is that all?
I just know the major storyline is very accurate. I don't know about the you know, the internal family sturm.
The embellished part.
I don't know whether that's embellished, but I do know that he did make it in the major. He ended up blowing out his arm again.
I wet buckets. I loved it.
Great. It's a great movie. It's fun. Yeah. All right, Dave, go ahead.
The movie's fine. The movie's fine. I just want to say this. There's a reason that nobody turns on MLB Network from October until March, and that's because they're playing The Rookie on loop for like 5 months.
I've seen The Natural.
You know how many times I've seen The Rookie on MLB Network? I can't even look at it anymore.
They show The Natural. I see The Natural on Brewster.
Please.
Rookie.
They should just call it Major League Rookie.
The Rookie is the Love Actually of baseball movies. Everybody wants to watch it at least
that's
twice
so
a
spot
year.
On,
no, that's a perfect catch. there you go. So if you're a Tampa Bay Rays fan, formerly Tampa Bay Devil Rays fan, see The Rookie with Dennis Quaid. Moving on to television and baseball reference in pop culture. One of the best shows I've seen in the past decade, let alone 20 years probably, I will put in my top 10 of all-time hilarious box sets, must-see. I guess it's very apropos with the U.S. election coming up. It's Veep with Julia Louis-Dreyfus. An HBO special. If you haven't seen Veep, I'll tell you what, you're going to have to see it twice because there are so many funny one-liners in each episode that you got to rewind and listen back because you end up laughing so much that you miss the ensuing jokes because of your laughter. It's just packed with comedy. But also, Julia Louis-Dreyfus plays a vice president who eventually... Very hot vice president. Selena Meyer is her name, and she's in the show. She's called Meyer the Liar. And as she pursues her presidential dreams in a few seasons of Veep. But the thing is, Julia Louis-Dreyfus is, in real life, a Baltimore Orioles fan, as was emulated and when she was on Seinfeld playing Elaine Bennis, where she gets tickets. George Costanza gets tickets in the owner's box. Steinbrenner was able to, give George these box seats, but she goes and sits down in Steinbrenner's seats wearing a Baltimore Orioles cap. And a few people sit in the section. You can't wear that Baltimore Orioles cap. You're sitting in the owner's box. He goes, I can wear whatever cap I want. And then hilarity ensues, of course, and Kramer gets hit in the head by a ball. But in Veep, she makes sure that her Baltimore Orioles are mentioned within the show as well. And she goes to Camden Yards, and there's a little cameo with Jim Palmer and Tommy Hunter and Jake Arrieta when he was then with the Baltimore Orioles. Veep, a must-see film, not just because of the Baltimore Orioles in it, but have any of you guys seen it?
Yeah.
Never seen it. Never seen it.
I'm kind of surprised she wasn't more of a Cubs fan. So she went to university at Northwestern, where I went to university, and started her comedy career in Chicago.
Yes. Which I forgot to bring waffles today, which I think we've all won a waffle award today for this episode 14.
You had a whole
moving on to the trivia answer, because earlier I asked you guys which manager that brought their teams into this year's 2020 postseason hit the most home runs as a player. And then I gave you three options. Was it A, Don Mattingly, B, Dusty Baker, or C, Aaron Boone? Which of those three managers has hit the most home runs?
So I want to go with Dusty because I love him, but I'm erring more towards Aaron Boone. That's my thoughts.
Really? That's strange, because I would think most people would think Mattingly, because he was probably objectively the best player of the three, but he was less a power guy.
Exactly.
And more of an average guy. I think Dusty's career is underrated, and he did hit for quite a bit of power. He was one of, like, I think the Dodgers were like five guys, who hit 30 home runs. I'm going to go with Dusty.
So Aaron Boone, you said Aaron Boone, Johnny?
Yeah, I've gone with Aaron Boone.
I thought Mattingly seemed the obvious choice. Boone would be the surprise, and so maybe that's where we're going. Just pick someone, Dave.
I'm going Mattingly. He lost a little bit of power late because he had back problems, but I'm going to go with him. He won the MVP in 85. He's my pick.
Okay, one of us is going to be right. This is a rarity.
There we go. So Don Mattingly, in his playing career, hit a career total of 222 home runs.
You're not going to win, Dave. He never mentions the winner first.
No, it's a trick. It's a trick.
Aaron Boone hit 126.
What?
He's a light hitter, Aaron Boone.
What?
No, I said no, Don Mattingly hit 222, but Dusty Baker hit 242.
Yay! Should have followed my instincts.
JC.
Not a trick. I thought it was a trick. Not a trick.
JC.
There you go. I've lost track of the score.
Hey Gouldy.
Yeah.
Bish Bosh, back of the net.
Sorry, how many fantasy titles have you got this season? I forget.
Fantasy baseball is an illusion. That's what they call it, fantasy.
Excuse me. We had a question in the mailbag. Is fantasy baseball actually more exciting than regular season baseball? This does not include playoff baseball.
Oh, are we in the mailbag now?
Well, we will be in a second.
Okay,
that was an untidy segue.
Because the
that's great.
Because the postman always rings twice.
Okay, time for the mailbag. And thank you for those of you who've been getting in touch. Actually, not that many this week compared to previous weeks. So everybody's getting obviously tied up with late nights watching playoff baseball, which I don't blame you. Steve Adams asked, guys, on Twitter, if the guys could put one person from history of the game in the Hall of Fame who currently isn't there, who would they choose? Does anyone pick Pete Rose? Steven Adams? I pick Pete Rose. What about the rest of you?
Yeah, I mean, either Rose or Joe Shoeless Joe. I think those are the two probably top contenders. I think that there needs to be more emphasis on defense. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but I think there's an argument that Mark Belanger, who was a great shortstop for the Orioles and a terrible hitter, but probably one of the greatest shortstops of all time, at least deserves consideration. I think that we get too focused on the long ball and batting average.
Gil Hodges.
Nice.
First baseman for the Dodgers, probably just a little bit short, but it would make my father very happy. He loved Gil Hodges. And, of course, he won the World Series in 1969 with the Mets as a manager. That's not supposed to count, but, you know, maybe a couple
should
extra
count.
Points.
Should count.
Yeah, Eric, I like that.
Yeah. Well,
Tigers, I think – Expos?
Well, no, well, obviously Pete Rose would go in as wearing an Expos cap.
Coco LaVoy.
57 games for the Montreal. There we go. It's, but, no, there's, I think every single – obviously Expo that was grown in and raised in the Expos organizations has already been inducted. But I will probably go, I'll stick up for Dale Murphy, actually. Just about. Short. He's borderline. He's borderline.
He's a great human. He should be in the great human Hall of Fame, not necessarily the baseball.
He
Hall
is
of
in
Fame.
All.
Who would buy tickets to that?
That's right. Two more from the mailbag, please.
So dark, Dave.
Okie dokie.
Debbie Downer.
Okay, well, JC, you said something about we're focusing too much on the long ball. Mike Dowling, I had a great chat, UK's number one Giants fan, with Mike, who said, what on earth has happened to the small ball? I'm basically paraphrasing here. He said, in that potentially deciding game six of the NLCS, the Braves had the bases loaded with no outs, but everyone comes in swinging from the hips. Everybody wants to hit the glory ball. Nobody's bunting. Nobody's stealing. And all you've got to do is get one run on the board. Get one run, another run. You don't have to hit grand slams. You don't have to hit three-run shots. What's happened to small ball, guys? And I think Mike makes a really good point.
I do agree in a certain sense, which is I think that a lot of hitters come up with a singular approach now, which is launch angle, you know, get backspin on the ball to allow it to carry. And when I grew up, there was the two strike approach. There was an approach depending on the way the defense was aligned, stay inside the ball, go to the right side. So you weren't, you know, you had to have a bag of tricks a little bit in terms of the way you approached hitting. And I think that that's happening less and less. And a lot of that's analytics, because you look over the percentages and you see that if you are doing the launch angle, if you are trying to go for the home run, over time, you're going to have success. And it's hard once you've made that determination then to pivot in a different direction.
The answer is, 43% of baseball general managers went to Ivy League schools. And that is why we don't bunt anymore, because they say don't bunt anymore. But Ned Yost bunted, and he won a World Series in 2015, which wasn't that long ago.
One more, please.
One more. Okay. Ian Blees has talked about how great the championship series have been, both in the AL and NL, both obviously going the full seven-game whack. He said both the comebacks that were or potentially were led by powerhouse shortstops who both go into free agency after 2021. But who's getting the bigger contract? Ian asks, is it Correa or is it Seager?
That's a great question, because, you know, both of them have dealt with injury. So both of them, you know, have that little red flag a little bit. Seager has been, and Correa too, both amazing postseasons. And so, you know, I think it's a bit of a wash. I think Correa is a little bit of the better athlete of the two. So I'd probably go Correa, but I think either one would make sense to me.
And the only question I haven't managed to get in, and actually this is the result of a lengthy conversation that I have on a regular basis with the legend that is James Holden, who of course has been helping us out on the Fantasy Baseball podcast, who asked the simple questions, why do clubs continue to hand out mega contracts? It doesn't seem to lead to postseason appearance. You talk about the obvious ones, Trout with the Angels, Bryce Harper with the Phillies, Gerrit Cole with the Yankees. I mean, you know, we talked about the Rays, and they're a bunch of, well, I don't want to use the word nobodies, but they're not superstars, but they're a phenomenal team getting phenomenal results, and they're in a World Series and potentially going to win one. So why do clubs continue with these ridiculous 10-year contracts that end up ultimately just dragging the team down? Pujols, perfect example, brilliant player, but you know, you're hanging on to him in his down years because you're paying him so much money.
This goes back to something David said earlier, and I was talking about too, which is money is a security blanket. And I think there's a PR element to it too, because you want to show your fan base you're doing everything in your power to win. And spending money is a very tangible way to express that. But I agree. You're paying for past performance with big contracts. And that is a really dangerous way to move forward. And the Rays, we talked about the A's, but the Rays are the island of misfit toys, getting all the way to the World Series. It's just very hard to thread that needle just right. It's not like the Rays have been going year in, year out, as good as they've been. A lot of stars need to align with players who aren't necessarily stars in order to make it all the way.
And by the way, don't think that owners of these big clubs who have more pressure from their fan bases than, say, the Rays, aren't watching everything that's going on. And this is going to be a huge issue going into the collective bargaining, because teams are more reluctant to pay for past performance than they, you know, today than they were, say, 5 years ago. And so this is all coming to a head. It's a great question. And we're going to see how this plays out for the next collective bargaining agreement. The players could take a huge hit here if they're not careful.
And I agree with Dave. I think we're already seeing it, which is that there are fewer of these contracts coming.
Yeah.
Into the mailbag.
And thank God Channel 5 took the same approach when they were hosting Channel 5 Baseball all those years ago with the small ball.
We were bunting a lot, weren't we, Goldie? A lot of hit and runs, a lot of sack flies.
lot of stolen bases. We were younger and fitter and a lot slimmer.
Very low payroll as well. Yeah. So there we go.
Island of Misfit Toys. That was us.
Well, guys, I'm afraid, as always, we've run out of time. Massive thanks to everyone that's listening in. Don't forget, on the social handles, we've got the Johnny and Josh Show on Facebook, on Twitter and Insta. It's at Johnny and Josh. Do get involved. Do subscribe. Do get all your friends listening. Do get the questions in. Do be a part of the family. We are definitely, I said we'd be doing a fantasy show this week. We never did. We're sort of waiting, really, to see how things pan out. But we will do one final season roundup on the Fantasy Podcast, and we'll mention when that's coming out. And before we go, the most important message of the week is an enormous happy birthday to Mrs. Michelle. Lengel, the
happy
legend,
birthday, Michelle.
Michelle.
Golden looked down. He had to read. He had to read her name. He looked down. I saw him.
By the way, Johnny, she likes you, but if she heard you call her Michelle Lengel, she would destroy you.
Because is that right? I said Mrs. Did. Lengel. I said Mrs. No. Lengel. Is that not
Mrs.
allowed?
Mrs. Lengel is my mother. She's Michelle Hova.
Okay,
she did not take, I'm way too weak to take my last name. She can't take my last name.
Can I offer one message to her, one birthday message from all of us on the show? You could have done so much better.
And on that note,
are you taking her anyway?
Yes, we know already.
Let me give you a little food recommendation, by the way, if you're taking her out for supper. You. The Grand Slam at Denny's is very nice.
Oh, that was yes.
With a milkshake.
To travel to another state for that, probably.
Get her a milkshake.
One more thing. It looks like we'll have an episode next week. It depends. It's all reliant on whether it's a 4-game sweep, whether it goes a full 7. Keep an eye on our social handles when our next episode will come out.
Well, that's it from this episode of the Johnny and Josh Show. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to all the boys for all their contributions. A huge congratulations to the Tampa Bay Rays and the LA Dodgers, who go to the World Series starting with Game 1 on Tuesday. Very best of luck to both of them. We look forward to having your company same time, same place next week on the Johnny and Josh Show.